Gerber's baby products and pediatrics reached its height of physical aggressiveness. No generation of kids got more shots or operations. Clothes designers targeted babies and children as distinct consumer groups rather than viewing them as little adults. Manufacturers made clothes tailored for babies and children's bodies for play and for, well, accidents. Barbie dolls, hula hoops, Davy Crockett coonskin caps, and other toys aimed at children appeared on the market, and other toys invented earlier, like Tinker Toys and Lionel Trains, saw their sales soar. In short, the baby boomers in general wanted for no material thing. In addition to growing up in abundance, the boom generation also was raised on the theories of the best-selling baby book of all time, Dr. Benjamin Spock's Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, 1946. Spock, thoroughly steeped in psychoanalysis and Freudianism, had been a Coolidge Republican in early adulthood, but along with his wife had moved steadily leftward, advocating positions that would have made Coolidge quiver. He advised parents to refrain from disciplining their children and to let children determine when and where everything took place, from bathroom habits to education. American homes overnight became child-centered, whereas spanking and other physical discipline was viewed as psychologically unhealthy. The dangerous combination of material comfort and loose control made for a generation that lacked toughness, one that literally fell apart under the pressures of civil rights, the Vietnam War, and economic stagnation. Not surprisingly, boomers turned to drugs and sex in record numbers, and divorce among the generation skyrocketed. Along with the permissiveness at home came an unparalleled freedom of travel and movement. Some of this movement was permanent relocation for jobs or better living conditions, including climate. Most of it was from north and east to south and west. Between 1947 and 1960, a quarter of a million Americans left the Great Lakes region and the Mid-Atlantic, New England areas for the far west, southwest, and southeast. At the same time, thousands of blacks left the South for higher wages and greater social freedom in the North, and Detroit, Michigan, for example, witnessed enormous population growth, making it the fifth largest American city by 1960, even as the Great Lakes region as a whole lost population. Nevertheless, the allure of better climate was unrelenting. Sunbelt regions netted a huge population gain in just over a decade, dramatically shifting both the economy and political balance of the country. Central cities saw their rate of growth slow as suburbs appeared around all the major metropolitan areas. Levittown, New York, built by William Levitt in 1947, created such a demand that by the time it was finished in 1951, it covered 1,200 acres with more than 17,000 homes, most of them owned by young families. Levittown quickly acquired the nickname Fertility Valley. Levitt's basic house consisted of a 720-square-foot Cape Cod constructed on a concrete slab, including a kitchen, two bedrooms, a bath, a living room with fireplace, and an attic with the potential for conversion into two more bedrooms. Basic models sold for just under $7,000, whereas larger versions went for $10,000. Many communities like Levittown were planned cities that sought to control the types of businesses, architecture, and developments that were permitted in an attempt to beautify the environment. Oversight by professionals in city planning represented the culmination of the dreams of the progressives who had once thought that central cities would evolve into what the suburbs, in fact, became. Yet once the planned communities arose, criticism of them from academics and urban advocates sprang up almost as fast. The soulless suburbs, it was said, were draining away the talent and wealth from the inner cities. Instead of praising lower crime rates in the suburbs, critics blamed the suburbanites for abandoning the core city. They failed to understand the basic human desire for security, privacy, and property. Travel for business and pleasure also expanded at geometric rates, thanks to the widespread availability of the family automobile. Autos had started to permeate American culture in the 1920s, but the expansion of auto travel slowed during the Depression and war. After 1946, however, people had several years' worth of wartime savings to spend, and General Motors and Ford, the giants, began to offer their own financing programs, making it still easier to acquire dependable transportation. A feedback loop, a self-reinforcing cycle, occurred as it had in the 1920s. As more people obtained autos, they demanded better roads, which state governments started to provide. And as more roads were laid, reaching more towns and cities, more people wanted cars. The big three automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, dominated the market, but many other small companies remained competitive, such as Jeep, Rambler, Nash, Checker, Willys, and the short-lived but high-selling Kaiser-Frazier cars. In the 1950s, U.S. auto production exceeded that of Great Britain, France, Japan, Sweden, and all other nations put together several times over. And Ford and GM, both of which produced their 50 millionth vehicles in the 1950s, posted healthy profits. Even before the 1956 National Highway Act was passed, building 41,000 miles of interstates, 60% of all American households owned a car, but most trips were local. The nation's more than 40 million cars traveled on some 1.6 million miles of surfaced highways, testifying to the fact that auto ownership had become common. Average annual highway driving rose 400% after the act, making interstate travel commonplace. But on the negative side, the fuel taxes remained in place long after the highway construction ended, and nearly 50 years later, almost half of the price of a gallon of gasoline consisted of federal, state, and local taxes. Indeed, the leftist notion that roads used tax dollars to subsidize auto travel fails to confront the reality that gasoline taxes ensured that the people who used the highways would, in fact, pay for them, even as they were also paying for the mass transit systems that the experts promoted. The unbridled liberty of the automobile irks those enamored of planning and control, those who see government-dominated mass transit systems as an ordered and structured alternative. It cannot be overstated how the automobile and its liberating powers created an American culture wholly different from that of the Europeans. In polls, Americans overwhelmingly identified the car as their object of desire, as embodying the conception of what it means to be modern and free. The Soviets desperately and unsuccessfully tried to copy Fordism as early as the 1920s, and things that Americans took for granted in the Cold War, such as jumping a line to buy a car or buying unauthorized parts, were criminalized in Russia and severely prosecuted. The drive-in theater, which had originated in Camden, New Jersey in the 1930s, came into its own as a cultural touchstone, especially for teenagers, with cars. By 1958, there were some 4,000 drive-ins in the USA. Air travel also entered a new democratic age. While still expensive, passenger flights became increasingly more available to more people, Air carriers such as Transworld Airlines, American, Pan Am, and others flew enough routes at low enough prices that by the late 1950s, average American families could consider taking an airplane flight to a vacation site or to see relatives. Juan Trippe's Pan American World Airways, which had flown directly to England by the 1930s and had mapped South American routes for security purposes during the war, emerged as a leading overseas carrier. Howard Hughes, who owned enough of Trans World Airlines, TWA, to assume hands-on management, started designing his own giant passenger aircraft even before the war, resulting in the Lockheed Constellation, which set an industry standard for size, comfort, and range. New technology converged with a glut of war-trained pilots who came on the market after 1945, producing lower fares. Eastern, American, and TWA offered coach-class tickets that made air travel competitive with rail travel, resulting in a doubling of airplane passengers between 1951 and 1958. The ease with which people traveled by air was, ironically, symbolized by the first air traffic jam over New York City in 1954, when 300 airliners lined up in holding patterns in the airspace around the metropolis, involving 45,000 passengers in delays. After Pan Am introduced a new transatlantic airliner designed specifically for passengers, the Douglas DC-7, Boeing matched it with the famous 707 jetliner, providing competition in passenger aircraft production that drove down prices. The frequency of air travel even produced a new term in the language, a physical and mental malady called jet lag. It goes without saying that Americans could fly and drive because their paychecks purchased more than ever before. In 1955, the average income for all industries, excluding farm labor, topped $4,220 per year, and by 1959, that had increased by another 10%. A New Orleans salesman with a high school education earned $400 per month. A Chicago private secretary pulled in about the same, and a Charlotte housekeeper received about $140 a month. Marilyn Monroe could command $100,000 a picture, just a little more than the $90,000 annual income earned by Peanuts cartoonist Charles Schulz. Such high wages bought a lot of potatoes at 51 cents per pound, or rice at 19 cents per pound, and even new electronics gadgets like movie projectors were within reach at $89. Chevrolet's Corvette, arguably the hottest car of the 1950s, had a sticker price of $3,670, or below the average annual salary in America. Cookie-cutter America? The newfound freedom on the highways and airways held a threat as well as a promise, for although people could break the restraints of their geography, social class, background, and family more easily than ever, they also were exposed to new and unfamiliar, often uncomfortable, social settings and customs. People responded by seeking a balance, embracing similar, almost uniform housing on the one hand, and enjoying their visits to other parts of the country on the other. The popularity of the famous Levittown subdivisions, where all houses were almost identical, have led some historians to mistake this need for order and the cost advantages resulting from economics of scale for an overarching quest for conformity. It was no such thing at all. Just as the adventurous pilot scans the landscape for a familiar topography every now and then, so too did Americans embrace individualism while they retained some sense of order. To see this, all one has to do is examine American travel patterns to observe how people eagerly entered into parts of the country that were in many ways foreign to them, even threatening. Yankees heading to Florida's vacation spots for the first time crossed through the redneck backwoods of the Old South. Easterners visiting California often encountered Asians for the first time. And Midwesterners taking new jobs in the Southwest were exposed to Indian or Mexican cultures and probably ate their first taco or tasted their first salsa. Even such things as housing — in Arizona, few multi-level homes were built because of the heat — food, and beverages differed greatly from place to place. Southern iced tea, for example, was always pre-sweetened, and so-called Mexican food in Texas hardly resembled Mexican food in California. Midwesterners who battled snows and rains all winter and spring had trouble relating to water politics in the West, where titanic struggles over the Colorado River consumed lawmakers and citizens. Food rapidly democratized and diversified, with the specialized dishes of the elites spreading to the middle class throughout the country. Soldiers who had come back from Italy had a yearning for pasta. New Yorkers who knew Coney Island learned the magic of the hot dog and took the concept with them as they traveled. Asian recipes moved inward from the coasts as Mexican cuisine surged northward. America's eating establishments became the most richly textured on the planet, with the most varied menus anywhere in the world. Within 30 years, Jamaican hot peppers, Indian curry sauce, flour tortillas, lox, teriyaki sauce, Dutch chocolates, innumerable pasta variations, and spices of all descriptions flooded the shelves of American grocers, allowing a cook in North Dakota to specialize in cashew chicken, New Orleans shrimp, or enchiladas. Not surprisingly, some of the most celebrated chefs to come out of this era drew upon their ethnic roots or experiences for their cooking. Martha Stewart, born Martha Kostyra, frequently prepared Polish dishes, and Julia Child, who worked in Asia with the Office of Strategic Services and then lived in Paris, where she learned to cook, had a broad first-hand exposure to foreign cuisine. Emeril Lagasse, another future star born in the early 1960s, earned his chef's apron in his parents' Portuguese bakery. Far from a decade of conformity, as expressed in the lamentations of books on corporate America, such as William White's The Organization Man, 1956, or Sloan Wilson's The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, 1955, the population had entered a period of sharp transition where technology was the handmaiden of turmoil. These books and others, such as David Reisman's The Lonely Crowd, 1950, emphasized a shift from rugged individualism to a team or corporate orientation. Reality was quite different. American conformity, in fact, kept the sudden and difficult transitions of the post-war world from careening out of control. It is not surprising that the two most popular movie stars of the day, the establishment's John Wayne and the counterculture's James Dean, in different ways celebrated rugged individualism, not conformity. No one symbolized the effort to maintain continuity between 1950s America and its small-town roots and patriotic past more than painter Norman Rockwell, 1894 to 1978, who in some ways was the most important and significant American artist in the history of the Republic. Born in New York, Rockwell left school in 1910 to study at the National Academy of Design. Almost immediately, his work found an audience and a market. He painted Christmas cards before he was 16, and while still a teenager, was hired to paint the covers of Boy's Life, the official publication of the Boy Scouts of America. Setting up a studio in New Rochelle, Rockwell worked for a number of magazines until he received a job in 1916 painting covers for the Saturday Evening Post, a magazine Rockwell called the greatest show window in America. In all, Rockwell painted 322 covers for the Post and illustrated children's books before he began painting for Look magazine. Critics despised Rockwell because he presented an honest yet sympathetic and loving view of America. He insisted on painting those scenes that captured the American spirit of family, independence, patriotism, and commitment to worship. Inspired by one of Franklin Roosevelt's speeches, Rockwell produced his masterpieces, The Four Freedoms, which ran in consecutive issues of The Post in 1943, along with interpretive essays by contemporary writers. Freedom from Want was inspired by his family's cook presenting a turkey at Thanksgiving. Freedom of Speech, possibly the best-known Rockwell painting of all, featured a small-town meeting in which a laborer in a brown leather jacket speaks with confidence about a bill or proposal tucked in his pocket. Rockwell did not ignore the serious deficiencies of American society. His 1964 Look painting, The Problem We All Live With, remains one of the most powerful indictments of racial discrimination ever produced. Depicting the desegregation of a New Orleans school district in 1960, Rockwell painted a little black girl, Ruby Bridges, being escorted into the formerly all-white school by four federal marshals. The wall in the background has the splattered remains of a tomato just under the graffito "nigger" that appears above her head. New Kids in the Neighborhood, 1967, pictures a moving van with two African-American kids standing beside it. The new kids staring at three white children who are looking at them with curiosity, not anger or fear. Rockwell's paintings captured stability in a sea of unraveling social and regional bonds. Religion tried to adapt to these changes, but failed. It took outsiders such as Billy Graham and Oral Roberts to cut through the serenity, comfort, and even sloth of the mainstream religions to get Christianity focused again on saving the lost and empowering the body of Christ. Clinging to stability and eschewing change came at a price. The lack of passion and avoidance of contention in many denominations triggered a staggering decline in membership. One researcher found that starting in 1955, the Methodist Church lost an average of 1,000 members every week for the next 30 years. In the mid-1950s, churches responded by becoming more traditional and turning down the doctrinal voltage. Churches were blocked from endorsing political candidates by a 1954 change in the Internal Revenue Service Code, sponsored by Senator Lyndon Johnson, Democrat, Texas, a power the government frequently wielded against only those religions whose message it disliked. Increasingly, Democrat candidates could be found electioneering in black churches without repercussions, but activities in mostly white suburban churches were closely scrutinized by the IRS. Although the words "under God" were added to the Pledge of Allegiance, thanks to a campaign by the Knights of Columbus, a distinct movement against government support of religion, and particularly Christianity, had emerged with the 1947 Everson versus Board of Education of the Township of Ewing, which seemed to separate all religion from government. That effort to de-Christianize American public life would fully bloom in the bans on prayer in public school early in the next decade. As religion grew less denominationally contentious, thus making it less important to live near those of a similar denomination, Americans found one less impediment to relocating to other cities or regions of the country. The market played a role in this sense of regional familiarity, too. Entire industries sprang up to meet the demands of an increasingly mobile population. For example, Kemmons Wilson, a Tennessee architect, traveled with his family extensively and was irritated by the quality of hotels and the fact that most hotels or motels charged extra for children. Wilson and his wife embarked on a cross-country trip in which they took copious notes about every motel and hotel where they stayed, size of rooms, facilities, cost, and so on. He then returned home to design the model motel of optimal size, comfort, and pricing, with kids staying free. The result, Holiday Inn, succeeded beyond Wilson's wildest dreams. By 1962, Wilson had 250 motels in some 35 states. Wilson saw standardization as the key. Each Holiday Inn had to be the same, more or less, as any other. That way, travelers could always count on a good night's sleep, as he said later. Americans' quest for familiar products, foods, and even fuel and music in an age of growing mobility produced a vast market waiting to be tapped. Ray Kroc saw that potential. A middle-aged paper cup salesman who had invented a multiple milkshake mixer, Kroc was impressed with a California hamburger stand owned by a pair of brothers named McDonald. He purchased the rights to the name and the recipes and standardized the food. All burgers, fries, and milkshakes at all locations had to be made in exactly the same way. In 1954, he opened the first McDonald's drive-in restaurant in Des Plaines, Illinois, replete with its characteristic golden arches. After 5 years, there were 200 McDonald's restaurants in the United States, and Kroc was opening 100 more per year. By the 21st century, fast food had become a derogatory term. But 50 years earlier, when truckers planned their stops at roadside truck cafes, the appearance of a McDonald's restaurant in the distance, with its consistent level of food quality, brought nothing but smiles. What Norman Rockwell had done for canvas, Kroc and Wilson did for food and lodging, in the sense that they provided buoys of familiarity in a sea of turbulence and international threats. Americans needed, indeed demanded, a number of consistent threads, from music to meals, from autos to dwellings, within which to navigate the sea of transformation in which they found themselves. The Invisible Man. One of the main arenas where Americans confronted radical change in the 1950s was in race relations. The continued injustice of a segregated society in which black people were either second-class citizens or, in more sophisticated cities, merely invisible, had finally started to change. Ralph Ellison's novel, The Invisible Man, eloquently captured the fact that to most white Americans, blacks simply did not exist. Television shows never depicted blacks in central roles. Black or nigger music, as white-dominated radio stations called it, was banned from playlists, as was Elvis Presley, whom disc jockeys thought was black early on. One could search in vain for African-American executives heading major white-owned companies. Few blacks were even remotely equal to whites in economic, political, or cultural power. This situation existed across the nation, where it was winked at or deliberately ignored by most whites. But in the South, racism was open and institutionalized in state and local laws. Since Plessy v. Ferguson, the doctrine of separate but equal had been applied to Southern public facilities, including schools, transportation, public restrooms, and drinking fountains, and in the vast majority of private restaurants and in the housing market. On municipal buses, for example, blacks were required to give up their seats to whites and were always expected to go to the back or middle of the bus. Segregation of the races divided everything from church services to whites-only diners. State universities in many southern states would not admit blacks, nor was any black, no matter how affluent, permitted to join country clubs or civic groups. Indeed, even as late as the 1990s, when the black Asian golfer Tiger Woods became the youngest pro golfer to win the Masters, he was prohibited from joining some of the private golf clubs at which he had played as part of the Professional Golfers Association tour. Also in the 1990s, famous televangelist Pastor Frederick K.C. Price was not invited to speak at certain churches because of his skin color. Large numbers, if not the vast majority of whites, entertained some racial prejudices, if not outright racism. Confederate flag wavers, white-robed Ku Klux Klansmen, whose organization had plummeted in membership since the 1920s, and pot-bellied Southern sheriffs could still be found, and they stood out as not-so-comical symbols of white racism. Equally dangerous to blacks, though, were well-meaning whites, especially Northeastern liberals, who practiced a quiet and perhaps equally systematic racism. Those northern white elites would enthusiastically and aggressively support the fight for civil rights in the South while carefully segregating their own children at all-white private schools. They overwhelmingly supported public school systems with their votes and their editorials, but insulated their own children from exposure to other races by sending them to Andover or Sidwell Friends. Few had personal acquaintances who were black, and fewer still, when it was in their power, appointed or promoted blacks to corporate, church, or community positions. Not surprisingly, this subterranean prejudice was at its worst in liberal meccas such as Hollywood and New York City, where television production headquarters selected the programming for virtually all TV broadcasting in the 1950s and early 1960s. With the notable exception of the radio show Amos and Andy, whose actors were actually white, black television characters were non-existent, except as occasional servants or for comic relief or as dancers. There were no black heroes on television. Worse, there were no black families. Black children did not have many good role models on television, and those African Americans they did see were seldom entrepreneurs, political leaders, or professionals. Perhaps not surprisingly, the wholesale exclusion of blacks from large segments of American society made African Americans suspicious of the few who did achieve positions of importance in white business or culture. Ellison's Invisible Man appropriately captured white America's treatment of more than 10% of its population. Hardly in the vanguard of civil rights, Eisenhower shielded himself from controversy behind the separation of powers. His position, while perhaps appropriate at times, nevertheless contradicted the constitutionally protected civil rights of blacks and cemented the view among black politicians that their only source of support was the Democratic Party. It is ironic, then, that two key events in America's racial history occurred during Eisenhower's presidency. The Legal Defense and Educational Fund of the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, led by its director, Attorney Thurgood Marshall, earlier had started to take on the separate but equal Plessy decision. Marshall had laid the groundwork with a Texas case, Sweat versus Painter, 1950, in which the Supreme Court found that intangible factors, such as isolation from the legal market, constituted inequality. The real breakthrough, however, came in 1954 through a case from Topeka, Kansas, in which the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown versus Board of Education overturned Plessy versus Ferguson and prohibited state-supported racial discrimination. The Reverend Oliver Brown, whose daughter Linda had to walk past a white school to catch her bus to a black school, had brought suit against the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. The board argued that its schools were separate but equal a la Plessy. In 1953, President Eisenhower had appointed a Republican, Earl Warren of California, as Chief Justice. This brought about a shift in the court against Plessy, which the court found inherently unequal. A year later, the court required that states with segregated districts, 21 states and the District of Columbia, desegregate with all deliberate speed. In 1956, southern states dominated by the Democrats issued a defiant Southern Manifesto, in which 19 senators and 81 congressmen promised to use all lawful means to reinstate segregation. The court's language and rulings after the case generated confusion, uncertainty, and resistance. Racist whites would argue that they were moving with all deliberate speed decades after the decision. Equally damaging on the other end of the scale, the court had stated that segregation generates a feeling of inferiority by blacks within the community, which implied that the only way blacks could overcome inferiority was to sit next to whites, a position that by the 1980s blacks came to ridicule. It further suggested that in any situation, even voluntary arrangements in which some preordained proportion of races was not achieved, it would generate a feeling of inferiority. Eisenhower thought the Brown decision set back racial progress, arguing that real integration could not be brought about by force. White resistance to integration involved citizens' councils, organizations that threatened blacks whose children attended white schools with economic retaliation, job loss, and other veiled intimidation. States that had made up the border areas in the Civil War, Maryland, Delaware, Kentucky, Missouri, Oklahoma, Kansas, grudgingly began to desegregate. Farther south, though, in the heart of Dixie, a full-scale offensive against desegregation ensued. Latching on to the Supreme Court's wording of all deliberate speed, the Deep South engaged in a massive foot-dragging campaign. In Little Rock, Arkansas, the city school board admitted 9 black students to Central High School. In response, Governor Orville Phobos, citing the likelihood of violence, encircled the high school with National Guard troops to prevent the students from entering. Eisenhower, after conferring with Phobos, concluded the Arkansas governor would remain intransigent. A federal court order forced the National Guard to withdraw, at which point the students again sought to enter the school. White mobs threatened to drag the students out and intimidated the authorities into removing the black students. A stunned Ike, who had only months earlier said he could not imagine sending federal troops to enforce integration, nationalized the Arkansas Guard and sent in 1,000 paratroopers to ensure the students' safety. Phobos then closed the schools, requiring yet another court ruling to pry them open. Further efforts at massive resistance, a phrase coined by Democrat Senator Harry F. Byrd of Virginia, led to state attempts to defund desegregated schools. But state and federal courts held firm, and supported with minimal enthusiasm by Eisenhower and then by Kennedy, the segregated structure finally began to fracture. As with much of the history of slavery and racism in America, the desegregation of schools ultimately had required a perversion of the apparatus of the state in order to get people to act responsibly and justly. The founders never imagined in their wildest dreams that federal courts would be determining the makeup of student bodies in a local high school. Yet the utter collapse of the state legislative process to act morally, or at the very least even effectively, pushed the courts into action. It was a cautionary tale. At every point in the past, the continued refusal of any group to abide by a modicum of decency and tolerance inevitably brought change, but also brought vast expansions of federal power that afflicted all, including the groups that initially benefited from the needed change. If lawsuits and federal action constituted one front in the struggle for civil rights, the wallet and the heart were two other critical battlefields. On December 1, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, police arrested a black seamstress, Rosa Parks, for refusing to give up her seat in the middle of the bus to a white man in defiance of a local ordinance. Blacks could sit in the middle, but only if no whites wanted the seat. Back of the bus not only embodied the actual laws of many southern states, but it also represented a society-wide attitude toward blacks. Several black activists, members of the Montgomery Women's Political Council, had looked for the proper ordinance to challenge. Her refusal to get back sparked an organized protest by the black community. Local black leaders met the following night in a Baptist church to use the power of the market to bring justice to Montgomery. They organized a boycott of the bus system under the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr., a young Atlanta-born pastor who had studied Thoreau and Gandhi as well as the Gospels. Contrary to a widely held view that later developed among conservatives, King specifically condemned and repudiated communism. A man with a mighty presence and a charismatic speaker, King had discerned that the battle was not about Montgomery. That was only a skirmish in the war for justice. And he developed a brilliant plan to use the innate goodness of many, if not most, Americans to turn the system. King promised his enemies to wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and in winning our freedom, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win you in the process. We are determined, he stated, to work and fight until justice runs down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. King's gamble hinged on the essential decency of Americans, and for every racist, he thought he could elicit the support of 5 non-racists. King also appreciated that for all its serious defects, the American system could actually work in his favor. Police might unleash dogs, fire hoses, and nightsticks, but at least in daytime, under the watchful eye of the press, they would not dare kill unarmed protesters. While these strategies germinated in his mind, he set to the task of leading the boycott. Blacks constituted the majority of riders on the Montgomery buses, and the protesters used carpools or simply walked as the income plummeted for the privately owned bus company. The boycott continued for months, and eventually the media began to notice. Finally, after a year, the Supreme Court let stand a lower court ruling stating that the separate but equal clause was no longer valid. Montgomery blacks, led by King, boarded buses and sat where they pleased. The moral issues in the initial civil rights cases in the 1950s and 1960s were crystal clear. But the steady encroachment of government into race relations later raised difficult issues about freedom of choice in America. Black economist Walter Williams has referred to forced association laws, noting that the logical outcome of defining every business as public increasingly restricts a person's freedom to choose those with whom he or she wishes to associate. In cases of genuinely public facilities, the issue is clear. All citizens pay taxes, and thus all citizens must have access without regard for race or color. But where was the line drawn? Private clubs? The logic of the issue transcended race. Did Christians or others whose religion dictated that they not aid and abet sin have to rent apartments to unmarried couples living together? Did Augusta National Golf Club, a private club, have to admit women contrary to its rules? Likewise, the firewall of states' rights also deteriorated in the civil rights clashes. A phrase used all too often by racist whites, the fact is that states' rights still represented a structural safeguard for all citizens of a state against direct federal action. Alongside Truman's desegregation of the armed forces in 1948 and Jackie Robinson's desegregation of Major League Baseball, the bus boycott and the Brown decision represented significant steps toward full equality for all citizens. But as always, the real lever of power remained the ballot. Since Reconstruction, Southern whites had systematically prevented blacks from voting or had made them pay dearly for going to the polls through intimidation, threats, and often outright violence. Poll taxes sought to eliminate poorer voters, and literacy tests could be easily manipulated, for instance, by allowing a white person to read only his name, whereas a black person would be required to interpret Beowulf or a Shakespearean play. Eisenhower offered the first civil rights law since Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Act of 1957. It established a civil rights commission and created a civil rights division inside the Justice Department specifically charged with prosecuting election crimes. Most Southern Democrats opposed the bill, and Southern Democratic governors would not support the law, leaving enforcement to the federal government, which was not equipped to police every precinct in the South. Far from revealing Ike's lack of commitment to civil rights, the president's position stated a reality that, again, underscored the basic structure of the federal system, which never intended Washington, D.C. to supervise voting in New Orleans or Richmond. More widespread change depended on a transformation of hearts and attitudes. When the next round of civil rights legislation emerged from Congress in 1964, public perceptions of race and racism had changed enough that large numbers of whites, both in the South and from the North, assisted in making it possible to enforce the laws. Black leaders did not simply wait timidly for attitudes to change. They actively worked to place racism and discrimination squarely in front of the American public. Following the successful bus boycott, Martin Luther King assembled some 100 black Christian ministers to establish the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. Assisted by another minister, Ralph Abernathy, King called on the leaders to engage in the struggle for equality with nonviolence, not as a symbol of weakness or cowardice, but with courage and persistence. Formation of the SCLC transferred leadership of the civil rights movements from the descendants of Northern freedmen of color to the Southerners who had to live daily with discrimination. From boring to booming, expectations at decade's end. Given America's position in the world, its tremendous wealth, the success with which it had resisted communism, and the fact that it had at least begun to confront some of its greatest domestic problems, most observers in 1959 would have predicted a marvelous decade ahead for the United States. Few would have imagined that within 10 years, the American economy would be nearly flat, that a continued foreign war would absorb tremendous amounts of blood and treasure, that society would find itself ripped asunder and torn by race, generation, and ideology. Fewer still would have foreseen the earthquake generated by the coming of age of the massive baby boom generation. The United States had gone through a particularly turbulent era whose dynamic upheavals and impetus toward freedom and individualism had been effectively masked and less effectively contained by powerful pressures of order. In the resulting cookie-cutter America, the outward signs of conformity concealed a decade of dramatic change in lifestyle, income, social mobility, religion, and racial attitudes. The seeds of virtually all of the revolutionary developments of the 1960s had already started to bloom before Eisenhower ever left the presidency. Chapter 19. The Age of Upheaval, 1960-74. The Fractured Decade. Following the perceived stability of the 1950s, a decade which in reality involved deep social change and substantial foreign threats, the 1960s were marked by unmistakable turmoil and conflict from policy divisions, racial clashes, and generational strife unseen in many generations. Much of the division came from the increasingly vocal presence of the baby boomers, exaggerated and sharpened by a foreign war, the assassination of a president, and, toward the end of the decade, economic stagnation that had not been seen since the end of World War II. The fractured decade of the 60s brought some needed social reforms, but also saddled the nation with long-term problems stemming directly from the very policies adopted during the period. Except perhaps for the decade between 1935 and 1945, the 1960s changed American life and culture more profoundly than any other 10-year period in the 20th century. Modern society continues to deal with many of the pathologies generated by the era of free love, tune in, turn on, and drop out, and rebellion. Every aspect of America's fabric, from national image and reputation to family life, experienced distasteful side effects from the upheaval that began when John F. Kennedy won the presidential election over Richard Nixon. Timeline: 1960, John F. Kennedy elected president. 1961, Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, Soviet Union erects Berlin Wall. 1962, Cuban Missile Crisis. 1963, John F. Kennedy assassinated, Lyndon B. Johnson assumes presidency. 1964, Johnson introduces Great Society legislation. Civil Rights Act passed. Tonkin Gulf Resolution. Ronald Reagan campaigns for Barry Goldwater's presidential campaign. Johnson defeats Goldwater. 1965. Johnson sends combat troops to Vietnam. 1968. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy assassinated. Richard Nixon elected president. 1969. United States lands man on the moon. 1971. 26th Amendment to the Constitution. Wage and price controls. 1972. Nixon visits China. Watergate break-in. Nixon re-elected. 1973. Nixon withdraws last of American troops from Vietnam. Roe versus Wade case decided. 1974. Nixon resigns. Gerald Ford assumes the presidency. It might have appeared that Richard Nixon should have waltzed to victory in 1960. He had numerous advantages. As vice president, he was associated with 8 years of peace and prosperity bestowed on the nation by Eisenhower. A former congressman with a record of being tough on communists, Nixon would be hard to attack on defense or national security issues. A well-read man and a solid, though hardly eloquent speaker, Nixon had held his own in debates with the Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Yet Nixon began the campaign as the underdog for several reasons. First, Eisenhower was no traditional Republican and more of a moderate. In his 8 years, he posed no threat to Franklin Roosevelt's legacy. Nixon, on the other hand, appeared to represent more of a break from the New Deal, although in reality his social and economic programs had far more in common with FDR than with a true conservative like Ronald Reagan. Second, public affection for Ike was personal, but Nixon generated little fondness. He seemed to have had only one or two genuine friends in his entire adult life. 20 years later, even those Nixon subordinates who had been caught up in the Watergate scandal, men who received jail sentences and had their careers destroyed, operated out of loyalty to the cause more than out of love for the man. Third, Nixon suffered from plain old bad timing. whereas the congenial Eisenhower, who did a great deal quietly, had met Americans' desire for a caretaker, the nation, having caught its breath, now gathered itself for another step in the ascent to greatness, or so many believed. Any candidate who could give voice to those aspirations, anyone who could lay out a vision, whether he had any intentions of acting on the promises or not, would have the edge in such a climate. Another factor worked against Nixon. Television. Nixon was the first public figure to use a television appearance to swing an election his way with his famous 1952 Checkers speech. But the tube became his enemy. It automatically benefited the more handsome and photogenic candidate. Television news favored the man better suited to deliver a sound bite, although the term had not yet been coined. Neither case fit Nixon. For the first time in American history, physical appearance played a large part in the selection of a president. Nixon had never viewed the press as his friend, and beginning with the 1960 election, the media actively worked against him. Eisenhower would be the last Republican president to receive favorable or even balanced and fair treatment by the increasingly liberal national mainstream press. And finally, Kennedy blatantly misrepresented and exploited the so-called missile gap, in which he claimed the Soviets had gained an advantage in nuclear weapons during the Eisenhower years. He knew better, having been briefed on the numbers by Ike's own staff, but used it as a campaign issue anyway. Nixon, unable to cite the real, secret U.S. advantage, had to sit back and take it. An irony of the election was that Richard Nixon and Jack Kennedy were friends, far more so than Nixon and Ike, or Kennedy and his running mate Lyndon Johnson. When JFK was in the hospital with back surgery and close to death, it was thought, Nixon wept. Kennedy, for his part, told loyalists that if he did not get the Democratic nomination, he would be voting for Nixon in the November general election. Friendship, however, did not stand in the way of winning. As it turned out, Kennedy did not have to go against his party. He carried an incredibly close election, but it is questionable whether he won the popular vote. Typical reports had Kennedy winning by about 120,000 votes. Little-known electoral quirks in Alabama and Georgia reduced Kennedy's popular totals. Unpledged Democratic votes for segregationist Democrat Harry F. Byrd and others, totaling 292,121, were lumped eventually with JFK's totals, giving him the final edge. Republican leaders, detecting fraud in two states, Texas and Illinois, urged Nixon to file a formal legal challenge and demand a recount. Earl Mazo, the national political correspondent for the New York Herald Tribune, examining the election returns in Texas, found that huge numbers of votes were dismissed on technicalities, whereas Kennedy had gained some 100,000 phantom ballots. Nixon lost the state by 46,000 votes, and then lost Illinois by less than 9,000 votes. Robert Finch, a Nixon confidant who later served as Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, said flatly that fraud had carried Texas and Illinois, and that Kennedy needed Missouri too, which was very close, but we didn't think he stole that. In one district in Texas where 86 people were registered to vote, Nixon got 24 votes. JFK got 148. Nixon refused to protest any of these states, saying an electoral crisis had to be avoided. It would take a year to get a full recount of Illinois, and Nixon did not want to put the country through the ordeal. He not only accepted the Electoral College verdict, but also contacted the Herald Tribune to insist that it abort a planned 12-article series detailing the fraud. It was a remarkable and civic-minded position taken by a man later excoriated for abusing power, and stands in stark relief to the actions of Al Gore in the 2000 election. Nixon never fully realized that in the contest with his friend JFK, he was pitted against one of the most ruthless candidates and political families in the 20th century. Kennedy and Crisis. John Kennedy's father, Joseph P. Kennedy, or Old Joe as friends called him, had risen from poverty to great wealth primarily through booze running during Prohibition. Having accumulated a black market fortune, Joe went legit during the market crash of 1929, buying when stock prices bottomed out and becoming a multimillionaire when stock values returned. By then, he had already decided his oldest son, Joseph P. Kennedy Jr., would one day become President of the United States. Roosevelt appointed Joseph Sr. Ambassador to Great Britain, an odd choice given that the Irish Kennedy hated the British. And John Fitzgerald, the second oldest son, studied in England. As war loomed, Joseph routinely blamed the British for failing to accommodate Hitler, as if the occupation of Czechoslovakia and the invasion of Poland occurred because Britain had not given Hitler enough concessions. John Kennedy supported his father, producing an undergraduate thesis on the arrival of war called While England Slept, an oddly pro-German treatment of the Munich Agreement, later made into a book by an affiliate of Joseph's and published as Kennedy's original work. During the war, at a time when all future political leaders were expected to do their military duty, Joseph Jr. went to fly patrol bombers in England. John had a safe position in naval intelligence in Washington. There, he struck up a sexual relationship with a woman named Inga Arvad, who was suspected by the FBI of being a Nazi spy. Aware of the potential danger to Jack, as John F. was called, Joe Kennedy arranged a sudden transfer several thousand miles from Inga Binga, as the FBI referred to her, to the South Pacific, where he added to his own legend. As commander of PT-109, Kennedy was engaged in a reconnaissance patrol mission at night when a Japanese destroyer rammed through the ship. The young commander apparently had posted no lookouts and had only one of three engines in gear, making escape impossible. Surviving crew members drifted throughout the night, then made it to a nearby atoll, whereupon Kennedy again swam back into the adjacent waters to try to flag down a U.S. ship. Eventually, a British coastal naval watcher facilitated the rescue. When search parties arrived, they had reporters with them, alerted by Joe Kennedy. And when the group finally reached safety, the British naval watcher was conveniently forgotten in place of the ambassador's heroic son. Jack certainly exemplified courage, endurance, and physical prowess in getting his crew to the island. A story on PT-109, turned into a Reader's Digest article that made JFK a war hero, led him to comment, "My story about the collision is getting better all the time." Not long after, Joseph Jr. died in a risky flight, making John next in line for political office in the eyes of his father. Upon his discharge, Jack entered politics, winning a House seat, then taking the 1952 Massachusetts Senate seat. JFK suffered from severe back problems, which required surgery that fused some of his vertebrae. While recuperating, he managed to write another book, Profiles in Courage, or so went the story. In fact, most of the actual research and writing came from a veritable who's who of academics, including historians Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and Alan Nevins, government professor James Burns, and reliable speechwriter Ted Sorensen, who would later be JFK's special counsel. Despite writing only a tiny fraction of the manuscript, Kennedy acted as though it were fully his, accepting the 1957 Pulitzer Prize for biography for it. There is no question Kennedy inherited several foreign policy messes from his predecessor, chief among them the recent overthrow of Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista by communist rebel Fidel Castro in 1959. Advisors to both Ike and JFK argued that the maximum leader, as Castro called himself, was merely an ardent nationalist and opportunist, much the way Ho Chi Minh of North Vietnam was later depicted. This was simply wrong, and was to no small degree fomented by some within the CIA. Castro encouraged such mischaracterizations, even though he claimed to have been a Marxist-Leninist when he started his guerrilla activities. Unfortunately, Eisenhower had offered diplomatic recognition to Castro's government. Within a few months, the administration realized it had blundered, and that a new Iron Curtain had dropped over Cuba, behind which stood a communist dictatorship easily as oppressive as any in Europe. Eisenhower also approved a CIA plan in March 1960 to organize an army of Cuban exiles recruited mostly in Miami and based in Guatemala. At the same time, the CIA plotted Castro's assassination, a project at which the agency proved so inept that it recruited Mafia dons John Rosselli, Santos Traficante, and Sam Giancana to provide hitmen to take out Castro. Although some of these more radical operations originated in the Eisenhower administration, unapproved by the president, Kennedy was fully briefed on all of them, and through surrogates issued his complete consent. He supposedly told a reporter that he was under terrific pressure from his advisors to have Castro assassinated. His brother, Robert F. Bobby Kennedy, was deeply involved in the intrigue. He knew about his brother's close ties to the mob through a sex partner named Judy Exner, whom Kennedy shared with Sam Giancana. The first flashpoint, however, involved not the assassination of Castro, which the CIA failed to pull off, but an invasion by the exiles at the Bay of Pigs, which occurred 3 months after the inauguration. Again, JFK reviewed and approved the operation. The administration secretly had in place an agreement with Cuban General Juan Almeida to take over with a pro-American government once Castro was gone. Castro had anticipated an invasion, having told Radio Havana that the State of the Union address had indicated a new attack on Cuba by the United States. Success for any invasion depended entirely on getting Castro out of the way first. As John Davis noted, the director's assassination was the very linchpin of the plan, an integral part, as Arthur Schlesinger had termed it. Kennedy even met with the Cuban national hired by the mafia to eliminate Castro, indicating he knew exactly whom to contact. On April 17, 1961, a small army of 1,400 Cuban exiles landed at the Bay of Pigs, where, they were assured, the U.S. fleet and CIA-operated warplanes would support the invasion. When things went badly, however, Kennedy suddenly withheld the promised support, dooming the invasion and sentencing the invaders to prison or death at Castro's hands. Anti-Castro elements never forgot that JFK had betrayed them. American public opinion was outraged by the Bay of Pigs failure and would have supported direct intervention. Chester Bowles, a senior member of the Kennedy administration, said that at least 90% of the people would have supported a decision to send troops into Cuba or otherwise overthrow Castro. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev viewed Kennedy's vacillation as weakness and decided to probe further. Khrushchev began testing Kennedy in Berlin, where the western half of the divided city offered an escape from communism. West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer had encouraged the refugees coming across the borders at a rate of 1,000 a day by July 1961. To staunch this hemorrhage, the East Germans, with Soviet permission, erected the massive Berlin Wall separating the two sections of the city. It was left to America to act. A Polk or a Teddy Roosevelt would have destroyed the wall immediately. Kennedy called up reservists and began a small-scale mobilization, but otherwise did nothing about the wall itself, which became a physical symbol of the Cold War. Its barbed wire, minefields, and tank traps, all facing inward, clearly illustrated that the chief task of communism was to keep people from leaving, not to keep invaders from entering. Kennedy's weakness in Berlin convinced Khrushchev that the United States would not resist communist expansion elsewhere. At Castro's urging, the Soviet Union had begun to place intermediate-range ballistic missiles, IRBMs, in Cuba. Subsequent letters have surfaced that reveal a wild, almost fanatical Castro hoping to goad the United States into a nuclear war. The IRBMs placed in Cuba posed a huge threat. These weapons had a 15-minute flight time to major United States cities, and their launch would provide only a few minutes for actual confirmation and warning, unlike Soviet land-based ICBMs that would have a 30-minute flight time. Khrushchev lied about the missiles to Kennedy, claiming that only anti-aircraft missiles had been sent to Cuba. U-2 spy planes soon revealed the truth. A flight in mid-October 1962 provided photographic confirmation not only of the IRBMs, but also of the surface-to-air SAM missiles protecting the nuclear missile sites. Kennedy's cabinet divided almost evenly. Some wanted to strike immediately with a full air attack and even an invasion, whereas others advocated going to the United Nations and invoking sanctions. Robert Kennedy came up with a third alternative, a quarantine or blockade of Cuba to keep incomplete weapons from being finished. It provided time to allow the Russians to back down gracefully. Kennedy announced the quarantine on October 22nd with a deadline on October 24th, cabling Khrushchev to return to the earlier situation before the missiles. Negotiating through an ABC newsman, John Scully, the Kennedy administration and the Russians floated several mutual solutions. On October 26th, Khrushchev, in a secret letter, offered to withdraw the missiles in return for a pledge by the United States not to invade Cuba. Shortly after the letter was tendered, the hardliners inside the Kremlin demanded that Khrushchev gain deeper concessions, which he submitted in a second letter, insisting on the removal of the U.S. missiles deployed in Turkey. Kennedy brilliantly pretended not to have received the second letter, then publicly acknowledged the first, offering the Soviet leader a way out, which he accepted. Castro reportedly responded by flying into a rage. His communist sidekick, Che Guevara, watched as Castro swore, smashed a mirror, and kicked a hole in a wall. Meanwhile, the Soviets had been embarrassed by allowing the Cuban dictator to egg them on, then were humiliated a second time when their post-operation intelligence showed that the U.S. Navy could have utterly destroyed the Soviet Atlantic fleet in a matter of